This is a continuation of Wild Grape Wine, or the poems in it. Roblin Mills, circa 1842. The wheels stopped, and the murmur of voices behind the flume's tremble stopped. The wind-high ships that sail from Rednersville to the sunrise ports of Europe are delayed somewhere in a toddling breeze. The black mill pond turns an unreflecting eye to look inward, like an idiot child locked in the basement, when strangers come whizzing past on the highway, above the dark green valley, 100 yards away. The mill space is empty, even stones are gone, or hands were shaken, and walls enclose laughter, saved up and brought here from the hot fields, and white dust floating above the watery mumble that leaves a mote or two to shimmer among the pollen, where bees dance now. Of all these things, and even an outline remains, no shadow on the soft air or broken place where the heavy walls pressed. And some of those, lost children of the time, kept after school, left alone in a graveyard, who may not change, or ever grow 6 inches in one hot summer, or turn where the great herons graze the sky's low silver, stand between the hours in a rotting village near the weed-grown eye that looks into itself deep in the black crystal that holds and contains the substance of shadows, manner and custom of the inarticulate, departures and morning rumors, gestures and almost touchings, announcements and arrival, gossip of someone's marriage, when a girl or tired farm woman whose body suddenly blushes beneath a faded house dress, with white expressionless face, turns to her awkward husband and the price of wheat and hogs. The black mill pond holds them, movings and reachings and fragments, the gear and tackle of living under the water eye, all things laid aside, discarded, forgotten, but they had their being once and left a place to stand on. Returned from Kikistan. Enough cracked ice for a billion cocktails. Sled dogs running along the beach like golfers searching for a lost ball. Leah and Regally waving goodbye as the motor stutters into blue water. And the road of the killer whales, with mile-long icebergs drifting south. And behind us, the lost island. Jonasy wears a terlene shirt, grins at me, where I shiver inside a parka. And I think about our relationship of mutual curiosity for 2 weeks. Jonasy, the basic and primary hunter, with other attributes secondary. He must be hunter to become husband and father. Crouched over, pretending to be a caribou, rifle ready on the tundra, or crawling behind cloth camouflage. He must be hunter to become husband and father, rifle ready on the tundra, or crawling behind cloth camouflage to shoot seal, growing old in the white land, as we all grow older. I am seized with dramatic melancholy for the young man in his middle twenties, soon to be middle-aged as myself. But I can't be sad long in this sunlight, like cold yellow beer, and the bow waves spattering blue ocean in my face. I think of the old ones, Dorsets who lived here when Christ was crucified, and Thule people gone 300 years, whalers, traders, explorers. I feel like a procession. But here is my turning point. These familiar islands, once so strange, Fox is farthest and Purdy is most, but the planets are receding. The air with its delicate balance has thumped against the horizon. At Pang, I pay Jonasy by prearrangement, the money embarrassing both of us, and we shake hands, his brown face already strange. I stand in the mud with my baggage, thinking of that island among the ice and the deep blue of Cumberland Sound, with its white whales and ringed seals. Feeling like Alexander Selkirk, who left his island, But Crusoe stayed there, among the goats and sled dogs. We'll never come back. That poem was finished a little bit later than the book, North of Summer, and hence was unable to be included. This poem is called Spring Song. It's been revised so many times that I keep wondering which revision I'm reading. However, I'm quite sure this is the last one, since it's about 2 days old. Spring Song. Old Father Me, in the classic rural tradition, listening to frogs lair up loopholes in silence, making sexual abstinence the ultimate blasphemy. Rabbits turn annoyed, having shut on the garbage all winter in near privacy. They dislike this noisy interruption and skitter into the willows. Crying birds of passage are overheard in the clouds, plotting a better world for starlings. Old Father Me, a kindly papa figure, doing push-ups under an ancient Pontiac, attempting to change the oil. Include me out of it all? Never. Even the farm girl is my two eyes. Include me out of it all? Never. Even the farm girl is my two eyes, twinkling hard against her jiggling jelly buttocks, swaying down the lane to the mailbox, wearing shorts in fig leaf weather. I'm rueful, but gratified at the young man's vehement twitching lechery inside an old man's inconvenient morals, under a senile Pontiac in the butter yellow sunlight, attempting to change the oil. You be damned, you professionally unhappy philosophers, followers of anyone not alive, whether under or above the ground, those sick prophesiers of doom girls with two heads and four buttocks wriggling down the lane to the mailbox, which is much too much of a good thing for a man who can't make up his mind anyway. Besides, even upside down under a ton of metal, such mutations keep an old man on his toes. The world's pain is a little away from here, and the hawk's burst of speed that claws a fish from its glass houses earlier and later than now, under a rejuvenated Pontiac, with frogs booming temporary sonatas for mortals, and Beethoven crows thronging the June skies, and everything still, everything suddenly still, with the sun a hovering golden bird, nothing moves, soft clouds wait, like houses floating in the sky, and the storm beyond the horizon waiting, high over the village of Ameliasburg, as if forever was now, and the grassroots knew it all. But they don't, you know, and here I am with my hands high under the skirts of the world, trying to figure it out too late, for someone breathed or sighed or spoke. The bright kaleidoscope alters, and here she comes, lilting back from the mailbox. My God, I'll never get to change the oil. Canadian. After reading the English newspaper caption, "Our Ruler in Aden," then rambling through pubs, graveyards, museums, art galleries, Dassault's, and the Tower of London, I felt at home only in graveyards. Hence visited St. Paul's, there encountering a big-nosed plaster bust that seemed familiar. Old John A., looking thirsty, not having had a drink for 75 years, and his immortal quote, "An Englishman I was born," and I felt decidedly annoyed with him, and passed without speaking. At Wellington's sarcophagus, a massive red marble cuspidor for elephants, who is he that cometh like an honored guest, that exemplifies generations of limy dead, leaning their musty weight on me, being unbearably English, all of them accusing me of having no past. Arrived here like a virgin's egg, immaculately conceived after reading Lady Chatterley in a dank northern hall bedroom. Wellington's bones inside the red cuspidor suddenly quacked and hissed at me, "You foreigner!" "Okay, that's all right," I muttered, playing for time, trying to think of a fast comeback for all of them, every single limey, all the dukes of this and that and the earls of something or other. "At least I'm alive," I said desperately, and felt this was inadequate. Timidly added, "You fossil." "Get lost," Wellington advised coldly. So I did, but swiped back my 2 shillings entrance fee from the inefficient old coin box on my way out into fresh air, and I felt better. Shoeshine Boys on the Avenida Juarez. These, I suppose, are the underdogs people are always talking about. But they're alive, for a genuine underdog is dead. Or else it's a matter of days or weeks until stigmata appears in his face. If I knew Spanish, I could talk to them. As it is, I ought to be feeling guilty, but the hell with that. In this context, they're happier than I am, which is a different thing than wearing a necktie, which may enhance contentment, though, by being a handy convertible hangman's noose. Later in the year, I'll catch up on happiness from an almost 100% reservoir of the stuff available day to day in each man's life. In the meantime, I get my shoe shined. Pay 1 peso and 20 centavos, 9.5 cents. Then I get my shoe shined again by the next boy on the Avenida Juarez. And the first boy is kind of mad. He thinks I think he didn't do a good job. The third shoeshine boy is middle-aged, with fat cheeks and a mustache. He seems to think I'm very funny. His mustache quivers and he laughs at me. Looking back, I see the first and second boys think I am nuts too, but they grin. And when I get my 20th shine, far away down the Avenida Juarez, past Alameda Park, all the way to Sanborn's House of Tiles, I see the brown shoeshine boys grinning, and my face is serious, for I badly needed all 20 shines. I've given no tips, though my socks are getting a little dirty. I'm getting a little sick of the idea, a little sick of myself for thinking of it, a little disgusted at being such a phony. The palimpsest of almost new black shoes as 20 grinning portraits I'm taking back to Canada on Tuesday morning via CPA. All the way down the Avenida Juarez, I see the grins go echoing farther and farther from mirror to mirror and mind to memory. Though the first is beginning to forget the reason he grinned. Maybe a sick wife is more important. And the 14th has seen through me and looks cynical and dislikes me, thinks I'm a phony. I think he's right. All down the Avenida Juarez, the grins have faded out completely. And probably only I shall remember. And the CIA man, 20 steps behind me, being crazy as hell one morning, writing a poem about it, and writing about writing a poem about it, making it into the echo of a poem. The echo of a grin on the Avenida Juarez. The echo of being alive once. The echo of dying on the Avenida Juarez. What really happened? There was just one shine. The guy put on quite a sideshow, panning a little to convince me he was doing a good job, because I was a North Americano. Then you could... Panting a little to convince me he was doing a good job, because I was a North Americano. Then got chased away by the cop in the beat, on account of overcharging me 1 peso, 8 cents. Or else he had no license to shine my shoes anyhow. Anyway, the grins were pretty cynical in the Avenida Juarez. And the 90-year-old Indian woman suckling her baby and selling lottery tickets sitting on the commercial bank steps grinned. Was told to move along on account of the cop, mistook it for happiness. The fake Greek sculptor with lipstick on the rumps in Alameda Park pseudo-grinned. And grins were pretty cynical on the Avenida Juarez. As cynical and sad as yours, maybe, after reading a poem sad and cynical as this one. But having 20 phantom shoeshines. A poem that isn't about anything, really. It gets so, you just can't trust nobody, eh? Mexico City, May 24, 1964. This also is a revision. One rural winter. It comes from the Caribou Horses. Trapped, cut off, marooned, like a city thief in a country jail. The rural mail, my only communication with outside. Surrounded by nothing but beautiful trees. And I hate beautiful trees. I'm lost beyond even the remote boundaries of Ameliasburg. I ask you, what could be more remote than a burg named after someone named Amelia, which even Amelia never heard of? Why, just close your eyes hard here and you don't see little dots of light. You see fresh cow pads. But it's winter now, beyond the economic wall. I have 2 nickels, a dime and a quarter. Not a damn cent in my pockets, but a wife who comes out at night when I'm asleep. Won't meet the burning stare of my closed, dreaming, womanless eyes. She's a damn coward, that's all. In the backyard, pieces of wood and stones embedded in ice. Notice the Freudian terminology, please. I'm trapped forever in the third post-atomic glacial period, making witty remarks like, "Cold out, ain't it, Zeke?" Scott, so I'm even afraid to go outside. I might catch my foot in a lateral moraine or something, and spend all my second childhood in Ameliasburg Township. The earth is frozen, the beautiful trees are frozen, even the mailbox is frostbitten, and I'm getting a little chilly myself, living in a house I built one tropical summer, with unemployment insurance and battered thumbnails. But I got into this mess myself, and I ain't blaming the class struggle. Besides, I can fool myself genuinely that things are going to get better in 10 or 20 years, maybe. No doubt it does improve my character to walk half a mile to the outdoor toilet with the temperature at 40 below zero. But McLean's magazine provides interesting toilet tissue, though all the spiders and microbes and things I train to sit up and chant in unison, "Hallelujah, what a bum," to a visiting imaginary females from the neighboring seminary, are frozen stiff. The place is warm and comfortable, as long as you keep your mind on the beautiful girl tacked in the wall, who advises me that spring is here, and I should have my crankcase flushed out. Then, plunging back to the house through skull-deep snow alone, the wind steals all my internal heat. My heavy body is doped with wind and cold, and the house door drags me into the hall, and the doorknob is a handle I hold onto the sky with. This one stems back to 1964 and being in Cuba then, over the Sierra Maestras. This was also right after counter-revolutionary raiders snuck in at night along the seacoast there and started pouring shellfire on a sugar mill. Riding the back of a bucking jeep through the Sierra Maestra Mountains, holding onto the canvas, hoping we don't leave the earth altogether. Red dust of Cuba seeps into clothes and hands and faces, like riding through an earth sunset. And lights in the dust are people's eyes. Pigs asleep on the road run squealing, chameleon lizards by the roadside. Palm thatch huts and heat haze, and the sea a thin line of blue lace, white edge, perhaps 25 miles away. The jeep driver must be a madman. We just miss a team of oxen. Once we nearly hit a truck. Our small red cloud and its big sunset join like dusty diarrhea with scarlet Spanish curses, and the jeep blushes. Pilan on the seacoast. Dusty small town like a movie set where man and boy clop past on a Hollywood nag, and hitch posts all over the place. We stand in dust and wait for Gary Cooper, who turns out to be the sugar mill manager, and shows us the damaged buildings where a sea raider opened up 2 days back with shellfire, wounding a pig, and hitting a woman on the buttocks with splinters, destroying the sugar warehouse, making a $1 million bonfire of mountainous slag sugar. Now a tall, gold-toothed Negro with a long Sherman's hook climbs over the slag heaps, grinning. The sun breaks his face into pieces of light. The road back, rain falling in the mountains. A hot rain, making pockmarks in moon country. Or would be, except for soaring royal palms. The live smell of red earth rising to your nostrils like animal urine, decayed flowers and tidal marshes, the not unpleasant smell of Cuba, so rank and fertile you think the jeep might sprout roots if you ever stopped, if you ever stopped. Your arms are tired rubbery tentacles, holding out of the reeling, bucking planet as the insomniac jeep, plunging through wheel ruts, takes you back where you came from. Ameliasburg Stew. In the bad days, no job and no money. Living in this rural paradise among the friendly cannibals. Eating rabbits when a neighbor killed one with his car. eating rabbit stew, week after week sometimes, and life was not just a bowl of cherries. In the moonlight, on snowy fields, they dance and sing together, celebrating amnesty with dogs, running on their hind legs like furry people with cold pink noses. One of them points to this house near the county road and mutters to a friend, "That's the guy that eats us. He lives there." They shudder together. The pink noses turn white. A cloud hides the moon. There's no one left in the snowy fields. Now I can't eat rabbit. The bloody patch on the road makes me remember the bad days and think this patch of smeared red jam on the highway will dance no more. Hemingway's villa in Cuba. A national museum, the guide says. Nobody can touch anything that was useful to him, but can't be used now. A table was set for dinner, as if Papa were on his way home. And the component parts of his body surely are moving in one direction or another. Mail unopened, books unread. Queer that we do this for the human dead. Venerate them so, I mean, not just remember. Make them gods, and then forget them, and pretend we don't. As the generations of pride leap from our loins and stride through the dust. But the tongue's pendulum anticipates its farthest limits, on either side of now. Though we touch the foretasted books of the mind, and trek the short distance mail comes from, and what was sent once, Jesus, and what was once said very well is silence. Some of these, a couple of them, I don't remember whether I read them before or not. I may have read that. Anyway, The Drunk Tank, which I'm sure of. About half of this is true, incidentally, in the first half. A man keeps hammering at the door. He is so noisy it makes my ears ache, yelling monotonously, "Let me out of here!" A caged light bulb floats in the ceiling, where dung fly circles round and round. And there is a greasy brown mattress, too small for the... Jesus, that shows you what beer will do, eh? A caged light bulb floats in the ceiling, where dung fly circles round and round. And there is a greasy brown mattress, too small for the bolted-down steel bunk, and a high barred window permitting fungus darkness to creep in the room's corners. The man keeps hammering at the door until a guard comes. "I just happen to know the mayor in this town," he tells the guard, "and it's going to be too bad for you if you keep me locked up here." The guard laughs and turns away. "It's no use," I tell my cellmate. "Just wait until morning. Then we'll be up in magistrate's court. Being drunk isn't a very serious..." "Who are you?" the man asks me. "I don't know you." "I'm your friend," I say to him. "I've been your friend a long time. Don't you remember?" "I don't know you at all," he screams. "Stay away from me." "That's the way you feel about it," I say. And suddenly I'm not so sure as I was. Memory is a funny thing, isn't it? "Please sit down and wait until morning," I say to him reasonably. "Don't you think that was the right thing to say?" But he turns his back and hammers on the door. "Guard, guard, I want a cell by myself. You put a crazy man in here with me. He's so noisy." And I watch him pounding on the black steel door, a patch of sweat spreading on his back and his bald spot glistening. He looks at me over his shoulder, terrified. And I spread my hands flat to show him I have the best of intentions. "Stay away from me, stay away." He backs off into a corner, shaking, while I sit down on the bunk to wait for morning. And I think, "This is my friend. I know it is my friend," I say to him. "Aren't you my friend?" But there he is at the door again. He is so noisy. The beach at Veradero, also Cuba. These multicolored people, the brown and black ones, and a lobster red man in the sun at Veradero, bulging from the human blueprint, standing in breakers for waves to slam against. A long way ago from the rock farm I was born on, a long way ago from Veradero, was my grandfather, building stone fences between clearings to measure time with, and hewing white pine flesh into cathedrals like barns, big enough for a farmer to turn outside in the summer, large enough for a man to know without seeing what trees already know. Far from the royal palms, far from the dusty latifundia, the red earth of Cuba, with little lizards darting from islands of shadow into seas of sunlight, far from the yellow sand, the son of my father, letting himself be knocked down by senseless water, only an object, a temporary barrier to the marching breakers, in a water valley, in a fragment of time, an hour before dinner, on the beach at Veradero, an Ontario farmer's son in a far country, thinking of my father's. House guest. For 2 months, we quarrel over socialism, poetry, how to boil water, doing the dishes, carpentry, Russian steel production figures, and whether you could believe them, and whether Toronto Maple Leafs would take it all that year. And maybe hockey was rather like a good jazz combo, never knowing what came next. Listening, how the new house, made with salvaged old lumber, bent a little in the wind, and dreamt of the trees it came from, the time it was traveling through, the world of snow moving all night in its blowing sleep, while we discussed ultimate responsibility for a pile of dirty dishes. Jews in the Negev, the Bible is mythic literature, peeking man, and in the early morning, looking outside to see the pink shapes of wind printed on snow, and a red sun tumbling upward, almost touching the house, and fretwork tracks of rabbits outside where the window light had lain. Last night, an audience watching us, quarreling, but keeping all our loves and hates inside the skin of friendship. Of course, there was wild grape wine and a stove full of Douglas fir, railway salvage, and lake ice cracking its bones in hard Ontario weather, and working with saw and hammer at the house all winter afternoon, disagreeing about how to pound nails, arguing vehemently over how to make good coffee, Marcus Aurelius, Spartacus, Plato, and Francois Villon. And it used to frustrate him terribly that even when I was wrong he couldn't prove it. And when I agreed with him, he was always suspicious, and thought he was wrong because I said he was right. Every night, the house shook from his snoring, a great motor driving us on into daylight, and the vibration was terrible. Every morning, I'd get up and say, "Look at the nails. You snored them out half an inch in the night." He'd believe me at first, and look, and get mad, and glare, and stare angrily out the window while I watched 10 miles of... and stare angrily out the windows while I watched 10 minutes of irritation drained from his eyes onto fields and farms and miles of snow. We quarreled over how dour I was in early morning and how cheerful he was for counterpoint. And I argued that a million years of evolution from snarling ape man had to be traversed before noon, and the desirability of murder in a case like his, and whether the Etruscans were really Semites, the Celtic invasion of Britain, European languages, Roman law. We argued about white being white, prove it, damn it, and cockroaches, bedbugs in Montreal, separatism, Nietzsche, Iroquois horsebreakers in the prairie, death of the individual and the ultimate destiny of man. And one night we quarrel over how to cook eggs. In the morning, driving to town, we hardly spoke. Water poured downhill outside all day long, for it was spring. When we were gone, with frogs mentioning lyrically Russian steel production figures in Robin Lakes were almost nil. I guess I was wrong about those eggs.